Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we talk with the Akron, Ohio rock duo, Grammy Award winners, the Black Keys. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review new music from Chewbacca and Hooray for the Riff Raff.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
That's a little bit of Insecurities from the new Chewbacca album, Perceive Its Beauty, Acknowledge Its Grace. Chewbacca, otherwise known as Chewbacca Hutchings. We've talked about him on the show before. This is his solo studio debut, but he is one of the kingpins of the London jazz scene. And people might think, jazz? London? It's been, the last decade has been amazing. A number of great artists have emerged from that scene. Chewbacca was born in London in 1984. He was raised in Birmingham and then Barbados, where his parents were originally from. Studied classical music and calypso and really came into jazz when he was 16. And mentored by the saxophonist Soweto Kinch, who was mixing jazz with hip-hop. And there's really the key to what Chewbacca Hutchings is doing. The purists will sneer at what Chewbacca's doing because he's not a jazz, you know, 50s acolyte. He is really moving the genre forward, which is one of the reasons we have addressed him. I've considered him one of the major artists of the last few years. He's in a bunch of bands, Chewbacca and the Ancestors, which is basically South African musicians along with Chewbacca. He led Sons of Kemet, this multi-genre UK quartet before its dissolution in 2022. Was part of that trio, The Comet Is Coming, which blended funk and rock influences with jazz.
You love them.
They were fantastic. He works with, you know, he's worked with Radiohead's Johnny Greenwood, Ethiopian jazz masters. He is all over the map musically. Chewbacca produced the new LP, his solo debut. And where have we heard this before? Hutchings is playing a variety of flutes on this album. We just reviewed that Andre 3000 record where he went ambient. Everybody was like going, what's going on here? Well, guess what? Chewbacca's in the same territory on this record. We're going to play I'll Do Whatever You Want with Laraji, who was an ambient pioneer championed by Jim.
Well, I was going to save it. Brian Eno Bell, please. Yes.
A pioneering ambient musician. So he is on that track, and you'll hear a little bit of his wordless vocals here in a bit.
That is I'll Do Whatever You Want. From Chewbacca, a little bit of Laraji in there, Eno Bell. I am not the jazz idiot I sometimes joke about being, I got a fairly hefty, bowing shelf full of jazz records, including half a dozen by Roland Kirk, okay? There's a name that I think when you think of jazz and flute, you've got to evoke. You know, and I would be fascinated to see Shabaka playing this material live because the range of flutes, I'm married to a flautist, mm-hmm. okay? But he is playing Mayan flutes, Brazilian flutes. He's playing Native American flutes, Slavic flutes. It is a veritable world tour of flute-like instruments, okay? But you got to explain to me this record, because, man, when it wasn't putting me to sleep, it was giving me the hives, all right? We say ambient jazz. The jazz I'm hearing is way too close to bad new age fusion, and the ambient is as it was with Andre 3000, just pretty much snooze inducing. I am not getting any joy from this record at all. I'm like, what is Cott thinking? He wants to talk about this record. You know, you're talking about hip-hop. Yes, more, please. There's not enough.
Well, I disagree. I do think that this is a superior record to the Andre 3000, just as using one point. And we really shouldn't limit.
I'm not so sure.
We really shouldn't limit what we're talking about just to those two figures. I think the reason they're newsworthy is because they are jumping into an area which is pretty fertile ground the last 10 years, especially.
Recent high-profile ambient jazz flute records. I mean, there's two.
Right. And, you know, he's one of those musicians who can't be pinned down. I think this is another indication of that. It's interesting that he chose to do this kind of a record as his solo debut. It's a side of him we haven't heard before. I would say this about this record, why I love it much more than the Andre 3000 record. First of all, it's 11 tracks, most of them in the 2 to 4 minute range. Mm-hmm. You know, Andre sort of blew out his the tracks, and it was
yeah.
it did get repetitive for me. This record has much more range to it stylistically. The fact that he's got 7 vocalists on it alone, I think, makes a difference. I think Charlie Overton as a harpist, he's played with like the Boston Orchestra. He's a classically trained musician. He's also in the jazz world. It's key to this record. You don't hear that too often on jazz records, but it's beautiful on this record. You know, I'll have to say, this was my soundtrack for the solar eclipse. I don't know how many of our listeners were out there, you know, with the glasses on, but I had to take a look at it.
I noticed and you're squinting a bit. I hope you had good glasses.
I did. My wife Deb got special glasses for it, and they were cheap, but they were very effective.
They had them down at Menards.
And they were great. It worked great. I was kind of moved by it. I thought it was kind of cool. I didn't expect to have any reaction at all. I go, mm-hmm. okay, I'll check this out. But, you know, and then playing this music that day just sort of fit in with the mood that I was in. So, maybe I'm a little bit biased.
You're getting a little hippie here. Now, wait a minute. You're talking about these vocalists. We have Saul Williams.
Moses Sumney. Laraji, the pioneering.
Andre 3000 does contribute to a track here on Tehotihuacan flute?
Yeah.
Flute, excuse me. And we have the great jazz bassist Esperanza Spalding.
She owns that track that she's on.
I disagree. All this
body to
talent. I don't know, man. This album, I'm not adult enough to appreciate it.
Tattoo with a needle and thread. Most of our friends are dead. So tested drugs, remember Narcan. There's a war on the people. What don't you understand? There's fentanyl. Everything don't become an angel with a broken wing. Oh, we need you back down here on earth, and nothing is as painful as birth.
That is a little bit of a track called Snake Plant, parentheses, The Past Is Still Alive, which is from the new album by Hooray for the Riff Raff called The Past Is Still Alive, Greg, appropriately enough.
We haven't talked about this artist before, but they are fascinating. Alinda Mariposa Segarra, raised by their aunt and uncle in the Bronx, surrounded by doo-wop and Motown of Puerto Rican heritage, and living these days in New Orleans and producing incredible alternative country, underground country music after a kind of folky roots. A tough life, and this album has a lot of insight into it. The rise from busking on the street, making these self-released acoustic records, to this new album produced by Brad Cook, who we recently talked about the production help behind Waxahachie's right. Tiger's Blood. Mm-hmm. Someone who's also worked with everyone from, talk about a range of artists, Annie DeFranco to the String Cheese Incident. if that doesn't intrigue you, the music certainly will. Let's play a little bit of the track Buffalo, my track of the year so far, from the new album, The Ninth, by Hooray for the Riff Raff.
2 weeks just to catch the buffalo. 2 weeks just to catch the buffalo. Will we go like the woolly mammoth or the deer dodo? Gone like the batchman's warbler, disappeared like the melting snow. Little Mary on a fruit bat or the bridled white-eyed bird. Or will we keep on running like the sound of the buffalo herd?
That is Buffalo from Hooray for the Riff Raff's new album, The Past Is Still Alive. Yes, Jim, I agree with you. That's a catchy track.
How long are we going to chase the buffalo? Can I insert myself? Usually, you know, you give your opinion first after I introduce or vice versa. Why am I playing this? Because there ain't that many buffalo left, right? And they're going extinct.
Very
we
true.
Have slaughtered them. And what Alinda is singing about is searching for something that may not exist or that may barely be there, which to me sums up this whole album.
It's going to disappear, yeah. We're going to try to catch it. It's going to take a long time to catch it, and it may not even be there when we get there. Right?
2 weeks just to find the buffalo.
It's a heavy-duty song, and I got to say, just even that little discussion we had about that song, for me, speaks to the whole album, how in the depth of this record and how good of a lyricist Alinda Segarra is. The albums immediately preceding this one sort of veered into pop and electronic music. And, mm-hmm. you know, I thought those were fine. But here, Alinda returns to where they began their career, the folk, the touches of country and rock, the subtle orchestration, in a brilliant way. Yeah, you're right. Brad Cook is a go-to person right now for a lot of these
kind
of artists. And he's doing a wonderful job here with Alinda Segarra. Talks about their past as a runaway, the present shadowed now by the ecosystem breaking down and the scourge of painkillers.
Yeah.
And it all ties in with her father's death. I mean, there's like heavy subject matter.
Well, from dumpster diving for dinner
to
watching dad die.
And the thing is, it's heavy in that respect, but you get one great tune after another, and everything's in this really taut, roughly three minute space.
Mm-hmm.
Segarra packs those minutes with lines brimming with, dare I say, poetry. I think some of this, the writing on this record is extraordinarily good, and it's packed into these tuneful packages. What happens to your mind when someone close to you dies, as their father did? Your life intertwines with theirs, and it comes back at you in fragments. You start thinking about these little snapshots from the past. I mean, I've experienced the death of one of my parents, you know, songs of memory and dreams, and then you've got this, you know, time and place sort of collapses, right? And that's what's happening in these songs, you know, a little shot of the past back to the present, and it's all merging together.
Suddenly a boulder is just sand in an hourglass.
Right. It's all in the past, but the past is still alive, as the song Vetiver goes.
Yeah.
that really sums up the album. It builds. When I got to Ogallala, I was just absolutely floored. That is a great sort of cathartic moment in the record, and it all builds to that place. It doesn't make linear sense, but it packs this real wallop. It advances to the head of the line is one of my favorite tracks of the year, if not my favorite track of the year.
Better than Buffalo?
You know, Buffalo's great, but Ogallala is just so emotionally devastating. Ogallala, Nebraska, what does that have to do with it? The deck of the Titanic, the back of a San Francisco bookstore. Mm. And again, it's all these kind of little memories shooting through the song. It's literary. I it's almost like an overstating it, but it's just a beautiful album on so many levels.
Well, that is what we thought of the new albums from Shabaka, and hooray for the riffraff. But as always, we want to hear from you. What do you make of these records? Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org. We might play it on the show. When we come back, we'll talk with the eclectic rock duo, The Black Keys. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we're back. The Black Keys started off self-producing records in basements back in Akron, Ohio, but with their propulsive drums and those blues-inspired guitar riffs, Patrick Carney and Dan Auerbach became one of the greatest rock acts to emerge in the 21st century. I mean, there are keystones of that garage rock revival.
Oh, absolutely. Now, an amazing 12 studio albums later, Dan and Patrick are still searching for exciting ways to make records. With the latest album, Ohio Players, the band invited some incredible musicians from Beck to Booker T. Jones to write with them. In our chat, we talk about the album, the band's unique origins, a new documentary, Bojack Horseman, and a lot more.
We're here with the Black Keys, Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney. Welcome, guys.
What's up? Thanks for having us.
How you guys doing?
I love the name of the new album. Ohio Players, man. People don't realize Ohio is like a fountainhead of funk and R&B. I was there a year ago, and people were welcoming a lakeside, anticipating a lakeside show. Like Led Zeppelin had reunited or
right.
Something like that. It was unbelievable. Anyway, Ohio Players, tell us about that. Why that name in particular for your 12th studio album?
Well, I don't really know. I think it might have been subliminal, actually, because we were trying to think of an album cover image, and we found this photo of a woman bowling from the 60s, taken from behind. And, you know, it's just like, I just remember bowling with my grandparents, how it's just like, you know, it's a very provocative image, you know, but it is also like, you know, the most kind of docile, like, run-of-the-mill activity. And I think looking at that and a few other factors of playing these 45s and at these DJ nights and kind of constantly seeing Ohio Players 45s, it came into our options of titles. But I think it is the closest we have ever come to having an Ohio Players style album cover. You know, I remember in the 90s going to Goodwill buying vinyl a lot, and there, you know, you would just see endless supply of Ohio Players records in Ohio, and
yeah,
they all had like, you know, naked women getting honey poured on them and stuff.
Yeah. That is very true.
Well, this comes on the back of a brief hiatus of a couple of years for you fellas. What was the impetus in coming together again? What made you say, yeah, we have something else to say? There's another album to be made.
Well, we just kind of burned out after, you know, 5 years of really heavy, 6 years of really heavy work and touring. And I think we had to figure out what it all meant. And we had projects and families and things we had to attend to, and when we started getting back in the studio to make music after a 3 year break, that was in 2018. You know, the number one priority for us was how to do the band without letting it just completely overtake everything that we care about in our lives, so we can attend to, you know, our families, our hobbies, and still have a lot of fun doing the band. So we've put a lot of effort into trying to, you know, find that magic, like, Goldilocks zone. That said, I think we worked more last year than we have maybe really ever, because we spent, you know, we went on tour for, we played probably 50 shows, but we also spent weeks recording in LA, weeks recording in Nashville. We basically were, you know, we probably worked like 250 days last year when it came to the band.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dan, I'd seen a quote from you that we'd never worked harder to make a record than this one.
Oh, we definitely never worked for a longer period of time on a record. You know, I think we probably worked longer than a year on this album.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it was because it was so spontaneous, and we were traveling to do it, to work with different people and fitting it in between some touring. So we took our time. We didn't book 2 weeks and say, we got to make a record.
Mm, right.
You know, we just, we went from song to song, just accumulating songs, really.
So it wasn't a painful thing. It was more like you were able to take your time and do it the way you wanted.
It was fun as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's the reason we started the band was because we liked recording. We got a record deal before we'd ever played a show. You know, we were always a recording thing. And when we burned out is when we were playing too many shows and not doing any recording.
Yeah.
We weren't getting to be creative. So, you know, that's one of our main focuses now, is kind of like balancing that stuff out a little bit better.
You know, you guys were kind of an insular band too, starting out. It was basically the two of you guys making
records. Not kind of. I mean, we were pretty
really
savagely insular. We would crawl down into the basement and not come out.
And I remember talking to you guys when you got Danger Mouse involved, and it was kind of a big deal. Like, do we really want to let this guy in the group, right?
So stupid. We were, you know, We learned how to do everything together musically. You know, we really had no idea what we were doing, and we were so isolated in Akron. There was not much of a scene there. You know, we had to drive 45 minutes north to play our first show. It's like, I guess it took us a little longer to learn how to, you know, work with other people, which is normal for everybody else, it seems like, you know.
Mm.
Every artist I love seems like they would go from album to album working with different collaborators, you know?
Well, that's obviously changed. And you've got a couple of impressive guest spots on this record, you know, with Noel Gallagher and Dan the Automator, Juicy J, Booker T. Jones, man.
And Beck.
And Beck. Oh, yeah, that guy.
That guy.
How'd these folks come to be involved?
Yeah, you know, we met Beck. I actually met Beck in 1996 on the Odelay tour when I was 16 years old. My Uncle Ralph, who played horns with a bunch of people, including Tom Waits, he knew Beck, and he knew I was going to go see this concert in Cleveland, so he arranged for me to get backstage passes. So Beck was the first rock star I ever met. And I was, you know, massive fan, still am. But Odelay, when it came out, just really blew my mind. It represented to me, like, you know, my Uncle Ralph was sending me all these cassettes in the mail back then, like lots of kind of out there stuff, like, you know, I don't know, Can and the Shags and like a lot of like 90s kind of reissues of weird 60s lounge music. And he was feeding me this kind of outsider perspective. And when I heard Odelay, it was like Beck had taken all that stuff and kind of made something really fun and, you know, just like a sampler of all things eclectic. And anyway, we ended up meeting Beck. We were on tour with Sleater Kinney in 2003, and they took us to an SNL after party after we played New York City together. And Beck was the musical guest of SNL that week. And I just happened to have a promo of what was Thick Freakness before it came out. This was in February of 2003. And I gave him that CD. And a couple weeks later, he invited us out on tour. And we opened for his US Sea Change tour that summer. And during that time, we'd always talk about how it'd be so fun to make some music together. It just took 19 years for us to get into the studio together.
Took a while.
Yeah. But yeah, he was always at the top of the list of collaborators because, you know, each record he does, you know, is just so interesting, and they're connected, but you know, there's just a fun approach to everything he's doing. And you know, he's a lyrical genius. And we finally got in the studio with him. We had some songs kind of started, and he just sat right down with pen and paper, and like within an hour, he had written the lyrics to This Is Nowhere. And, you know, and it's crazy being in the studio with someone that you've been a fan of since the time when I first became aware of music, you know, and watch and working, and Dan and I getting to collaborate with him and not just collaborate, but make something that we are all proud of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we kept tapping Beck because he was like the oracle of lyrics. We ended up writing about 12 songs with him.
Wow.
And he wrote like 18 songs worth of lyrics for those 12 songs.
Yeah.
Comes easy for some folks, I guess.
Well, he's the Dada poet, right? Collaboration was obviously a big part of this record. And having done this before with Danger Mouse, the vibe might have been different. But what were you looking for? Patrick, you said with Beck you had skeleton of a song or the beginnings of a song, and they came in and finished it up. Was it pretty much the same process with everybody, or did somebody come to you with a song and said, hey, could you guys work on this? Or, you know, how did it work in general?
I mean, the way that Dan and I started making music together in the 90s when we would go into, you know, my basement or take the four-track to Dan's parents' bathroom, it always revolved around getting something recorded, like making something that we could listen to. So when it came to working with Noel, we approached it differently than working with Beck. And, you know, we sat around the studio in London, you know, in Toe Rag Studio, which is pretty, very small, very straightforward studio that forced us to not get distracted with sounds or editing or any bull. We just posted up and started throwing ideas, grooves around, chord changes, and within a couple hours we had a completed take of the song that became You'll Pay. Everything except lyrics, you know, all the changes, all the melodies were there.
Dan, before we get another second past this, what was so magical about your parents' bathroom?
It just was tiled, you know, so we were looking
to get a good reverb.
Good acoustics, yeah.
Yeah. Love no, it didn't actually sound very good.
No, it probably sounded horrible, but we didn't know. We used to, like, we would, like, tape microphones to like, the kick drum, and I would wear a microphone sometimes.
Yeah, you know how, like, the old doo-wop groups said that they would go into the old tile bathrooms and sing, and they'd have that luxurious echo. that was not this. It sounded really bad.
Yeah.
Pat was sat on the toilet as the drum throne. Yeah. And we just set his drums up in front of it, the amp in the tub.
Better as a story than in reality, yeah.
I might need to update my drum throne for this tour, actually.
Your drum throne.
It's amazing no one has done that, right? You know, touring with the portable toilet.
Actually, you know what? We got to change the title of the album. It needs to be American Standard. It's actually
that's good.
It's actually a better title.
Yeah.
Oh my
yeah,
god.
Yeah.
Stop the Press.
That is a better title.
It's
that
a, better,
is a
title.
Better title.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what you guys have done on your own and what you brought back from those experiences to the Black Keys. You know, Dan, we loved that Yola record. and we had her on the show. What a force of energy, you know. But, man, that's just one credit. You know, Dr. John, Lana Del Rey, CeeLo.
Robert Finley, man.
Hank Jr. Oh, Finley, too. We talked to him. Boy, that was interesting.
That was one of the most bizarre interviews. I don't know, was he like that in the studio? Where, you know, he was talking about, you know, chauffeuring people around, but he's blind and
he can't actually see the road. Yeah.
Nuts of stuff.
Yeah.
He was, what a character. I mean, that must have been something.
We hired him. He's going to drive our bus on this upcoming call.
Fair warning, everybody stay out of the way.
Yeah, no, it's like being in the Black Keys allows me the freedom to do those kind of records, you know, to pick the records that aren't pop records, the ones that, you know, I don't have to worry about them making money necessarily. I can just kind of find something I really love and work on it. And more recently, the two worlds have kind of collided more and more, and it's just kind of, it seems like it makes everything better, you know, strengthens everything, you know. Mm-hmm. We were working on the Robert Finley record, and I invited Kenny Brown up and Eric Deaton. And that's when I called Pat, and he came over and we did Delta Cream. And that, like, Delta Cream sort of rolled right into us. Like, that was the first time we really collaborated live in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of got the ball rolling, you know? We invited Greg Cartwright on the next album, and hey, it was kind of fun. Let's dig into the Rolodex a little bit deeper. And that's when we reached out to Beck. So it's all connected, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
And Patrick, no slouch yourself. You've worked with Michelle Branch. And did you get to meet BoJack Horseman? I got to ask.
Well, I've hung out with Will Arnett, so I guess that counts.
Writing the theme song for that. What do you feel you bring back to the Black Keys after this other studio work?
Well, you know, I think, I stayed pretty busy during the time we took off. I made a record. I made a handful of records, maybe seven or eight. I don't know. I learned a lot during that process. I also really gained perspective on how important the band is to me and how fun it is to make music with Dan and what it's like to have a partner in crime where, you know, whenever we're met with like a creative kind of challenge, it's like I think we both enjoy trying to figure it out, and I think, you know, I'm always proud of the work we do. So, you know, I've been doing less and less outside producing, just focusing more on the band. It's where I get everything I need currently, you know. And so, like, it's good, and I like being there to support all the stuff Dan's working on with Easy Eye and, you know, everything. It just feels, like Dan said, very connected and very, we've been having a lot of fun, you know, and I think it comes through in the new album. Like, we spent, you know, we worked so much last year, but it never felt like work. It felt, you know, like we were undertaking a big creative challenge of trying to make something. I think for me, I'm always thinking in terms of, I don't know, kind of patterns and stuff. And when we crossed into that 20-year mark being a band, I started really thinking about like what that means and how many bands have gotten to get to that point and how many bands then make a record that you want to put on that they made 20 plus years in. And I was like, that started becoming a real priority to me, is like wanted to make something that really stood out in the catalog. And so it took, you know, it took a lot of work.
Coming up, how the Black Keys put together this latest record, Ohio Players. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. We're talking with Patrick Carney and Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys about the process of making their latest record, Ohio Players. Let's get back into the conversation. You know, it's interesting, the Beautiful People single, and I thought it was great. And for a few other people, who were fans of yours, I said, hey, have you heard the new Black Keys single? And they said, yeah, it's good, but it doesn't sound anything like them. And I'm like, did you ever hear their work? They did this project called Black Rock, you know, back in the day. I mean, it's kind of been in your DNA all along. I always feel like and naming the record Ohio Players, you know, I feel it's more like you're acknowledging your roots more than maybe people realize where you're coming from with that groove stuff. I don't know. Maybe I'm just speculating.
I mean, we listen to all kinds of music, you know. And I mean, for Dan, I think alternative rock is probably the least, you know, listened to, you know, genre of music for him. And, yeah, you know, when we first made Tighten Up, it was also like, you know, I think it really stood out. It was like Black Keys fans were like, what is this? You know? Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to keep pushing yourself to make stuff that feels interesting, you know, and the label chose that as the first single because it seemed to have the most, some, you know, broader appeal. But, you know, there's a lot of songs on this record that we're excited for people to hear. And when the album releases, the single changes to one of the songs we wrote with Noel Gallagher on The Game, which I think, you know, when you start hearing the whole record together, I think it will start making more sense.
How'd you come to choose the William Bell cover, I Forgot to Be Your Lover?
That was one of our favorite songs forever. Mm. And we were in this amazing studio in Los Angeles called Valentine, which is an absolute time capsule. It was built in the early 60s. And then it was closed for decades and nothing changed. Mm. And 8 years ago, a guy found it, rediscovered it, and opened it. And it's just incredible time capsule from the 60s. And we were in there and we were just feeling it, you know? Mm-hmm. And Pat suggested, why don't we do that song? Mm. And we had our friend Kelly Finnegan with us, and Tommy Brennick, and we gave it a shot. Mm. We didn't really think about it too much at all. I mean, it wasn't even like, this is going to definitely be on the record. We just thought, we're in this inspiring place. Let's cut one of our favorite 60s songs.
You know, when you cut a song like that, I'm curious, you know, how many songs you have in play for a particular record. Like, is that sounds like it was just a total fun, let's do this spontaneous kind of moment. And it may or may not be for the record, but we just enjoyed doing it. How do you go about the process of selecting what's actually going to be on the record? I assume you wrote more songs than you actually needed, but maybe not.
Well, Beck wrote a couple dozen.
Yeah. Right.
We probably wrote more songs for this record than we ever have. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a very long time, we were sure that we were going to be releasing a double album. Wow. You know, we had upwards of 50 songs that were finished, or wow, close to, anyway. Yeah, we had to really start to whittle them down, and it took forever. And we had so many songs that we even asked for help from David Byther from our label, Nonesuch. And that's the first time we've ever asked for assistance during the process of making a record from mm-hmm. a label. And it was super helpful, helped us sequence the record in the end.
It gets to be a Sophie's Choice. I mean, they all mean something to you guys. You recorded them.
Well, you could just, there were so many songs that you could sequence them in different ways that would just be completely different albums.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
we'd been working on them for so long that we were in over our heads, man.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be like a basement tapes collection at some point of the other 40.
No, there's definitely going to be some more songs released shortly.
But, that's cool. You know, yeah. And then the process, that's a lot of songs. So you guys were super productive and you probably were knocking stuff out relatively quickly. But I do remember talking to you, the breakthrough song, Tighten Up. I think, Dan, you told me that you worked something like 2 days on that song, like 14 hours or something like that. And there were some records that you made in about that same amount of time. That was kind of a breakthrough in some ways for you guys. And I'm wondering, have you gone back to that where you are laboring over certain songs and they are over an extended period of time, or do you find that stuff is still sort of pouring out in a more spontaneous fashion like it was in the early days?
It's a little bit of both. I think that it's really important for Pat and me to have a raw recording. Even if it's a song we've worked on a long time, at the root of the song, the foundation of the recording, we really want there to be a raw take. You know what I mean? Like the songs that we wrote with Noel, man, it's just us in a circle in a tiny room recording together. And that's what you hear on the record. It's the second or third pass, you know? So, you know, we definitely pay attention to stuff like that a little bit more than normal. But, you know, we made Delta Cream in like the same amount of time, like, you know, 13, 14 hours.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But this was different. We were just being so picky, you know, and these record hangs that we were doing, spinning records and DJing and collecting 45s and like having this, you know, friendly, competitive thing, trying to find records. We were getting extra picky. You know, we would have our record box, and then like a couple months later, some of the ones that you thought would never leave your box because they're so good, you're taking them out because you've found stuff that's better. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of spilled over into the studio work. We kind of were getting extra picky and really taking our time.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't mentioned the documentary. This is a film about the Black Keys. As clear a title as Ohio Players might be elliptical. How's it feel to be stars now of sound and screen?
Yeah, the doc, it premiered at South by Southwest a couple weeks ago. And, you know, it was something that was suggested to us by a friend of ours who ended up producing the doc. And yeah, it ended up being like a lot more work than we anticipated as far as like, you know, the interviews and
a lot more money too.
But it cost you, not that you were paid, right?
Yeah, it was like they kept, you know, having to get investors to give them money. But you know, it was important to us, I think, because I think that a lot of people came onto the band like when we were on our sixth album, and I started realizing, you know, talking to even journalists, like that they just don't even know the origins of the band. They don't know how we met, and you know, the fact that we make all of our own albums. It was just, I wanted to have something that, like, I kept thinking about if I could see this film when I was 15 in Akron and getting into music, if I could see the story that Dan and I have about what we had to do and all the luck and all the hard work, it maybe it could just be inspirational to someone who's trying to get into music, you know, because when I was a teenager, you know, my uncle, you know, was a musician, but I was definitely told by my family, like, that's a really good hobby to have, but you you don't want to do that unless you want to be destitute the rest of your life.
Right.
You know, and we got to a place where, you know, Dan and I were both in college, dropped out, you know, realizing that we weren't going to gain anything from a degree. And so it was like, it made more sense to us to just go into my basement at this punk rock house I lived in and make a record and get in a van and go play shows and try to make that happen. And, you know, we had no backup plan. And I think we had to really commit. And luckily, we both were on the same page. I think at one point there was a third guy that was jamming with us. He departed the band very early on. But I always think about, like, if he hadn't left, like, we probably wouldn't have made it through the first tour, you know?
And it, you know, modest beginnings, incredibly modest, and you guys were modest about yourselves for a long time. And the next thing you know, you got a hit and you're playing an arena, you know, 20,000 people. I remember when you guys played Lollapalooza, I think the accumulated audience there would have been, you know, equal to what you had played in total prior to that or something along those lines. And then I remember you going on, there was a scene that sticks in my mind. You were on Colbert. He said something like really almost like ridiculously Colbertian. I was like, you guys are on a rocket ship to the moon. And you guys just sort of looked at him like, what are you talking to me? You know, it's just like this priceless look. So was there ever a point where you kind of go like, what is happening here? Like, we're not supposed to be here. We're not supposed to be on national television. We're not supposed to be playing, you know, the headlining slot at Lollapalooza and all this stuff in front of 100,000 people. I mean, it's just kind of this... Was there ever that disconnect moment, or did it feel kind of organic and natural?
Yeah, you know, it definitely was surreal, like, when our career started exploding. And I'd always kind of, I ground myself by, like, you know, if we were in Madison Square Garden, I wouldn't think about Led Zeppelin performing there. I would think about, like, oh, this is where the Blue Man Group performs or something. Like, this is, like, where the circus happens or, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, no, you know, I think... I'd never attended a concert in an arena, you know, prior to us opening for Pearl Jam at Madison Square Garden. So, yeah, there was a learning curve for me because I just associated it all with big events and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, now they don't feel overwhelming, you know, they feel exciting. And you know, it feels really good to have people wanting to hear your music, you know. It's like... I think we spent so many years like playing clubs where like the record store clerk would be, you know, in the back of the room with their arms crossed. For me, you know, it was hard to like get past like, are people here to judge us or are people here to have fun? You know? And
Well, you guys are such accomplished crate diggers. We can't have you on Sound Opinions hosted forever by two rock critics and not ask you for a Desert Island pick for the day. You know, not to define you for all time, but if there's a song you can't live without that you'd want to play right now as soon as we're done chatting, what would it be?
Dan has one. There's a song that kind of blew our minds that Dan found. it's a cumbia song just done with synthesizers.
Yeah. Cumbia de Sa. Mm. Like a Moog synth cumbia album that was made in the early 70s. And there's this record called Cumbia de Sa. And my girlfriend found it and played it for me. And I found the 45 and it's just so good. We play it every night. It's like a heavy cumbia with rock and roll drums on it. It's so fun.
What's the name of the artist?
Cumbia and Moog. It's just like
That's cool.
A various artists LP, but I found an original 45 on Fuentes, and it's like just so killer.
I love cumbia. I love Moogs. There was that weird period in the early 70s where every genre had to make a Moog.
Had the Moog, yeah.
Some fared better than others.
This one is super good.
Love it. Patrick, what about you, man?
Yeah, I guess, if we're going to go to the record hang stuff, one song I always play is by the Ambassadors, Philly soul group, called I Really Love You. There's a few versions of this song, obviously, but this is the version that we play every time.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, my dad's friend was a DJ, a disc jockey. He gave me a box of promo stuff that the radio station was throwing away, and this was right when Dan and I started touring, and on there was a Philly soul comp and in the box. And also there was a Jerry Butler compilation. Mm-hmm. So that was when I first started getting into the Philly stuff. We ended up covering, Never Gonna Give You Up by Jerry Butler on Brothers. But, I don't know. I think it just sounds incredible, and also it's on this label Arctic, that, I think there's maybe 10 or 12 releases and some of them are very expensive, but I've been slowly whittling that list of getting them all. they all sound incredible. That's the thing about some of that Philly soul is that the drums kind of almost sound like John Bonham could be playing them.
Yeah, they're amazing records, and they hold up. That's the incredible stuff, made in the 70s and still sounds great, Like, it hasn't aged a bit.
Well, and you were talking before about that L.A. studio. I mean, there are certain rooms that have a kind of magic, apparently not including Dan's parents' bathroom, but others that you go downtown here to Chess Records, which is not much of a museum. There's nothing in it, right? But just the four walls, and you kind of clap your hands and it's like, oh, okay, all right, I see what happened here.
That's the magic of those places. They all have their own little particular sounds, and that's what made them so great.
Even though they're often smaller than you'd think they would be, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of them are smaller. Most of them are very weird. Mm-hmm. Most of them are very homemade.
Yeah.
That's what made them so special.
Yeah, I was in High Records, the Willie Mitchell studio in Memphis. You guys have probably been there a billion times, but you think about all the stuff, and then they got the microphone where Al Green sang, and it's just like this holy, this place.
Yeah, Willie
Mitchell's
just like, that studio is completely unique. That's like, they called that like the burlap palace. It was just, and everyone's hunkered down in their own little burlap box, basically. You can't even really see the people you're playing with, which when you think about the records that he cut, they're kind of a little more laid back, reserved. You can kind of imagine that might be an effect of being isolated from the other people all the time. I think his records might be my favorite sounding of anybody.
Those are incredible records.
And Willie Mitchell records just jump out of the speakers.
Great producer. Well, we could talk records all day. And thanks, guys. Appreciate you coming on. Congratulations on the new record, your 12th. 20-plus years as a band, starting out in a little basement in
Akron.
In Ohio.
And now a movie, too.
Yeah, that's all right. Anyway, thanks for being our guest.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, that wraps up our conversation with the Black Keys. And as always, we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, and share your thoughts. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to talk college radio. At some point, most of our listeners, I think, got exposed to a lot of cool new music through college radio.
Absolutely.
And we're going to talk with an author of a new book on the subject and talk about where college radio is now and where it's heading. And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Good times. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our Columbia College intern, talk about college radio, Max Hatlam. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.